Hey, this is Brian Zond, and I'm glad that you're interested in the podcast. You know, it's a free podcast, and it'll always be that way. But if you would like to give and help us out, that would be awesome, deeply appreciated. If you want to do that, you can do that through the Word of Life website or through the Word of Life mobile app. Anyway, God bless you. I hope you enjoy the podcast.
Choose your own adventure. We're going to start in Philippians chapter 1. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 21. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I am hard pressed between the two. My desire is to depart to be with Christ, for that is far better, but to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. The Apostle Paul pens these words while he is sitting in a Roman prison. He has been imprisoned for preaching the gospel. The gospel was not just the announcement of the beginning of a new religion for the Roman Empire. Cared little about the religion of indigenous people. Paul was in prison for preaching the gospel that Jesus is King, that Jesus is Lord. And this was a true affront to the worship given to Caesar. Rome already had a king. Rome already had a Lord. It was Caesar. But Paul was preaching a different way, a different good news that Jesus is Lord, and by implication, when you say Jesus is Lord, it means Caesar is not. Paul finds himself locked away in prison. That's when he wrote this letter to the church in Philippi, while in prison. And while lying on that cold prison floor, Paul was weighing his options. He could, on one hand, live and continue his work of establishing new churches, of establishing these communities of faith, of preaching the gospel as he had been doing. Or, on the other hand, he could face execution by the Romans. And he says to do so, he would find himself face to face in the presence of Jesus. And Paul says, yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. He was undecided. Paul was a prisoner. He was derailed and detained by the Roman officials, and yet he has the audacity to say, I am making a choice. Prisoners are often not given many choices. But Paul, sitting in a prison cell, thinking about his options, says, yes, I still have a choice. Very much like Jesus, Paul is saying, no man takes my life from me. I willingly lay it down. Paul has a choice to make. He is at a fork in the road. He is at a crossroads with a decision to make. Which way will he go? The interesting thing is that Paul is working through his options, and he sees Jesus on the other side of either option. Did you catch that? Jesus said, if I go the way of life, to live is Christ. So if I go that way of life and I continue to live, I can preach the gospel of Christ. I can build churches and communities of Christ. Jesus is on that side. If I go the way of life and I live. But he says, if I give myself over to my captors and am executed and killed, well, I see Christ there as well. Paul says to die is gain in the sense that to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. I find it interesting that in this way, Paul is free to choose his own adventure, knowing that Jesus is on the other side, regardless of the way he goes. Now, the title of the message tonight, Choose Your Own Adventure, is from chapter 6 of Jonathan Martin's new book, How to Survive a Shipwreck. I read this book over the last few weeks, and I just finished it up last week. And I knew that of all the good stuff in here, I wanted to preach chapter 6, which is entitled Choose Your Own Adventure. Some of you will remember Jonathan Martin. He preached here on a Sunday morning at Word of Life in October of 2014. Real tall guy, if you remember. He preached that message where he talked about God works through our weaknesses and God uses us through our weakness. It's not that God uses us in spite of our weaknesses, but God uses us through our weaknesses. Jonathan had just gone through a shipwreck of his own, which included his resignation from the church that he had founded and started. Some people will remember the story he tells in the beginning about going to Sweden and renting a little bitty European car, this big old tall American in this tiny car. Anybody remember the story? And he's driving and he hadn't figured out how to put it in reverse. And he's going down these winding streets and he ends up between two buildings, literally stuck between two buildings. He can't open the door and he can't figure out reverse. And it was, you know, totally embarrassing because as an American, if you're in Europe, you don't want to look like the stereotypical dumb American. But he ended up looking like the dumb American. And as he was telling the story, the newspaper came out and took his picture. And he was on the front page of the paper. That's how bad it is. He tells that story also in the book. I'm happy to announce that Jonathan is going to be back at Word of Life Church in September. Jonathan is currently living in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where he's the teaching pastor at Sanctuary Church, and he's going to be here on Sunday, September 18th. He'll be the first person preaching after Pastor Brian and Perry go on their sabbatical. So Jonathan will be here in just about 2 months or so, so I'm excited to have him with us. But Jonathan wrote this book to talk about his own shipwreck, both personally and within his family and within his church, and he shares his struggle and his pain, and it's wonderful. I highly recommend it. I think there's one copy left in Solomon's Port, so early bird gets the worm. So whenever you can get it, he'll have books when he's here in September, so there's time. But I thought it was great. But in particular, I love chapter 6. So I wanted to read just a little bit to you from chapter 6, Choose Your Own Adventure, as a part of my sermon by the same title. So here are the words from Jonathan. He writes, "It's so heartbreaking when people feel like they are forced or coerced into knowing and loving God. You must love God or else. In the very act of saying you must, we virtually ensure the person will never feel they actually choose God for themselves. When we do not feel we have a choice, we cannot truly make one. We are cut off from living out of our depths and thus cut off ultimately from ourselves. Before shipwreck, many people don't have a sense they are actually choosing their own lives. Because we are designed to make choices, wholeness is not possible as long as the life we live is not the life we have chosen all the way to the bottom. Our life is not entirely our life until it becomes the life we've chosen." I want you to think about that line for just a little bit, that last line that I read to you. Just think about that for just a moment. Our life is not entirely our life until it becomes the life we've chosen. Faith is a journey, and life is an adventure. And it is an adventure of our own choosing. God has made us and created us to make choices, and we find that those choices begin to make us. And I want you to begin to see your life like that. That in your life, just like Paul, you face crossroads, decisions that have to be made, and God has empowered you to make decisions. life and faith really is a choose your own adventure. Now, Jonathan got that title from the book series that was super popular in the 1980s and the 1990s, the Choose Your Own Adventure books. I loved them when I was a kid and read them. Loved it so much that I bought one recently as a way to get ready for this message. And I forgot how much I enjoyed these books. How many of you remember Choose Your Own Adventure books? Anybody? A couple of you. Okay, Choose Your Own Adventure books. These books were written, started in the mid-80s through the 90s. There was a time they were out of print. They're all back in print now. So if you're interested, you can go online and find them. But the idea behind Choose Your Own Adventure is that this book, and again, this book is written for tweeners, you know, for like a 10 to 14-year-old, kind of like pre-teen, right? It's all before Nickelodeon and all this television program for tweeners, right? So when I was like 10, 11, 12 years old, it was Choose Your Own Adventure. And it's written in the second person so that you, the reader, become the main character of the story. And so if I can, I'm doing this purely to indulge myself in my childhood for a little bit. Let me give you a little taste of Choose Your Own Adventure so you know how these books work. And I won't have time to do the whole thing with you. I actually took my six-year-old Dylan through it last night and let him be the main character. And I asked him to make all the choices. Because what happens in the book is you'll be reading along and then you as the main character are faced with a choice. You have to open the door and go through the tunnel or go back the way you came. Which will you choose? And it was so fun to watch my six-year-old because I'd ask him. I'm like, well, it's your choice. Which one do you want to do? You know, sometimes you'd be like, which one is dangerous? Because this one was entitled The Abominable Snowman. You know, and he's like, well, which one is dangerous? And you got to choose. You got to choose. And so what's interesting, too, about these stories is that this one in particular has 28 different endings. Some are good, some are not so good. Okay, let me give you a little taste of it. So here it is. And again, it's second person. I'm talking about you here, so you're the main character. You are a mountain climber. 3 years ago, you spent the summer at a climbing school in the mountains of Colorado. Your instructor said that you had natural skills as a climber. Some of you are thinking, I would never climb a mountain. Are you crazy? Use your imagination, people. It won't work unless you do that. You made rapid progress. You did good. And by the end of the summer, you were a leading climber, climbing difficult rocks and even making ice climbs. That summer, you became close friends with a boy named Carlos. The two of you made a good climbing team. Then the story goes on. You're told that you and Carlos go on these expeditions together, climbing mountains. You become great friends. And on one expedition, you hear about the abominable snowman, the Yeti that lives in the Himalayan mountains, the Asian Bigfoot. You hear these stories. So you and Carlos start talking like, we got to find a Yeti. We got to go to the Himalayas. We got to find him. All right, now I'm going to pick up the story. This is what brings you to Kathmandu, the capital city of Nepal. But your problems have already begun. 2 days ago, Carlos left the helicopter. You took a helicopter there. You don't know this, but I'm telling you. You took a helicopter. 2 days ago, Carlos left by helicopter to look over the terrain near Mount Everest. But the helicopter returned without him. The pilot told you that Carlos decided to stay up at the Everest base camp to check out a report that a Yeti had been seen. He has a radio transmitter, but you have received no word from him. The weather turned bad, and radio communication was interrupted. You have an appointment to speak with R.N. Runal, the director of expeditions and mountain research, and an authority on the Yeti. He knows of your plans. You will need his help with official permits for your expedition. He will also have good advice and information. But what about Carlos? Okay, now you have a decision to make. If you decide to cancel your meeting with Runal and search for Carlos, turn to page 7. If you feel that Carlos is okay and go ahead with your plan to meet Runal, turn to page 8. Now you have to borrow the book if you want to know what to do, because that's all I'm going to tell you. But you get the picture here. This is the way the book works. So you don't read straight through the book. You come to these crossroads and you have to make a decision. What are you going to do? Go on with your meeting with the expedition leader or go find your friend Carlos. And the decisions you make will affect your adventure. Also affects the length of your adventure. And I think that this choose your own adventure is a wonderful picture of our lives. Because this is the way we live our life. Faith indeed is a journey. Life indeed is an adventure. We are constantly confronted with these forks in the road where we have to make decisions. Do we go that way or do we go this way? What's the right way? What would God want us to do? Where do we go? What do we do? This happens all the time. Things happen at work. And it demands a response. People run over us, talk bad about us, or mean, offend us. And we got to decide what to do. National tragedies hit, and we struggle to know what to feel, what to do, what to say. And if you are raising kids, it feels like you're making these decisions by the hour. Do I end their life, or do I let them live another day? Which way do I go? This is the life that we lead. I mean, every day you get up and have to decide, what am I going to wear? What am I going to eat? What am I going to do with my money? This is the way we live our life. Life is an adventure based on our choices. And God has given us the capacity for real, authentic choice. I mean, God is not a puppet master. And we are not puppets on a string being manipulated, just going along with whatever God has foreordained. No, God has created us in His image with the capacity to make real choices. And when we begin to make choices, we find that those choices in turn form, in part, the very lives that we lead. And for so long, we thought God was only behind one door. And we have to find that one door, the right door, in order to be in, perhaps you've heard this phrase, the will of God. The will of God. The will of God is so predetermined and set that there's only one way to go. So when you're faced with a decision, one way is the right way, God's way, the other way is wrong, and you got to figure out to be in the will of God which way to go, which is the right way to go. The right way, the right door. This is something that I find that younger people who are serious about following Jesus, they're all anxious about this, right? They want to know, I got to pick the right college. What college is the will of God for me? Because they want to have the right career. What's the will of God for me? What career do I choose? I got to have the right school. I got to go to the right, take the right classes. I got to have the right career. I have to marry the right person. I got to buy the right car and buy the right house in the right neighborhood so my kids can go to the right schools. And we begin to think that there is only one right way, and we get frantic about that because we don't want to miss the will of God. This was me as a young person. I was 15 when I really began to take my faith seriously. I was baptized when I was 12, but at 15, I was dead set on following Jesus. By 16, I knew that I wanted to be a pastor. And so, I mean, I was a teenager and I liked to have fun like any normal teenager, but there was also a seriousness with me about my faith. And because I sensed a call to be a pastor, I wanted to make sure I was doing the right things. Particularly when I first started college, and I wasn't sure, am I going to the right college? And what am I supposed to do? I was frantic with making the right decisions because I wanted to be in God's will. And I didn't want to make decisions that would take me away from God's will. And one of those big decisions was, who am I going to marry? Jenny and I started dating when we were in high school. I was a senior and she was a sophomore. It was in my senior year. And we started dating. And into my freshman year of college, I began to question whether or not we were supposed to continue to date. And I hate to report, because I went off. Jenny was still here because she was still in high school, and I went away to college in Kirksville, Truman State. And I hate to report that I started treating her bad. I wasn't a very good boyfriend because, and it wasn't that I was trying to be a jerk. I just couldn't get out of my own way. It wasn't that I was trying to hurt her feelings, but I was in this point where I didn't know. And I began to have these thoughts. Is this the right person for me? If I'm going to be a pastor, is this the person that God has for me to be a partner in ministry? And I wasn't so sure. Because after all, I was a mature 18-year-old college student. And she was a 17-year-old high school student. So obviously, I was much more mature than she was. Not only that, I was much more spiritually mature than she was, in particular because she still self-identified as a Baptist. And we all know that those of us who are non-denominational, yes, we're freed from the constraints of denominations, are so much more spiritually mature than those Baptists. These are the thoughts that I had. And so I really thought, and so I came home one time and went to Godfather's Pizza. And not the one by the mall, but the one down South Belt. This is in the 90s. We went to Godfather's Pizza, and we actually had a conversation. And I said, I think we should break up. Because we were talking to our friends and our family and people that we loved and trust, and they all said, yep, you guys should break up. Break up. Break up. And I was thinking that too. And then I got a letter in the mail. Yeah, see, I went to college right before the internet happened. So when we were dating, I couldn't afford a long-distance plan at the college, and I couldn't afford a bag phone because the only cell phone back in the day came in a bag. Do you remember that? The phone was like the size of a shoe and had this, you know, as all the rich kids in college had that. So no cell phone, no email, no internet. We wrote letters back and forth. And so I checked my little, you know, college dorm mailbox, and I had this letter for Jenny. And I was reading it in the cafeteria. She wrote it on graph paper. I still have the letter, by the way. And I'm reading this letter, and she says, I think everyone is saying that we should break up, but I think God wants us to be together. And I was like, huh. That was actually my response. Huh. So I took that letter up to my dorm room, and I put it back on my desk. And I just kind of paced back and forth. I kept looking at that letter going, really? Huh. And really, God used that letter because I called her. It was expensive back in the day. He had long distance plans. It was expensive to call. I called her and apologized for being such a weasel and a jerk and ended up sending her flowers. And I said, let's stay together. And I'm happy to report that it was the right decision for me. And, of course, it was her great wisdom that kept us together. And so I appreciate her for that. That was good. I'm glad that we got married. It's been a good thing. 21 years of marriage. Still good. So that's good. Yeah. So it was the right choice. But what I have come to learn in so many of these decisions we make, who to marry, what job to take, questions like that, what I've come to learn is that when we're faced with those two doors, who do I marry? What college do I go to? What job? I have these different job offers. Which job do I take? When it comes to these type of things, I've learned to say that there is no right door. Because the will of God is not found behind one of them. The will of God can be found in any of them. Because God is actually behind all of these doors. One of the surprising things about following Jesus is we discover God is behind every door. We thought God's will was constricted to selecting the right door. This door is the will of God for my life. And that's it. There's no other choice. Any other choice, I'm outside of the will of God. I must go this way. I must marry this person. I must buy this car, go to this school, have this job. Anything else is outside the will of God. We used to think that way, but I think we're beginning to see that that's an untruth. That God is not just behind that door, that God is behind every door. That any door we go through, we can still find God. Because if you think the will of God is constricted to one door, if you continue to think that through, well, you don't end up in a good place. Because you can start asking questions like, well, was my mom and dad in the will of God when they got together and I was created. And if you keep thinking it through, you can go even further and it really gets worse. You can think about, well, were my grandparents in the will of God when they got married? Well, wait a second. Wait, if my grandparents were not in the will of God when they got married, that means my parents were born out of the will of God. And if they weren't in the will of God when they got together and I was conceived, then that means I'm not in the will. If you follow that train of thinking, it will lead you to a little place I like to call Crazy Town, USA. And it's simply not true. The will of God is bigger than these isolated decisions. The truth is that God is behind every door because there is no place where God is not. Listen to Psalm 139. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. One of the fundamental truths regarding the nature of God is that God is not limited by space, that God is indeed everywhere. John Wesley said, "And where no creature is, still God is there. The presence or absence of any or all creatures makes no difference with regard to him. He is equally in all or without all." And this kind of thinking, where can I go from your presence? If I ascend into heaven, descend down into the place of the dead, there you are. If I'm out at the sea, and even Wesley says, where there's no creature, God is still there. There is no place we can go and not find the presence of God. This begins to break down the false idea that God is the only found behind one door. So we can say it this way, when speaking of the will of God is not always the direction we go, but the kind of people we are becoming. So for instance, what is the will of God for my life? It isn't so much a direction as much as the kind of person you're becoming. Some of my favorite scriptures from Romans chapter 8, I go back to over and over, Romans 8, 28 and 29. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. And what is his purpose? What is his plan? For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed into the image of his Son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. So when people ask, I want to know the will of God for my life. What is the will of God for me? Our answer is the will of God for you to become like Jesus. So if people are asking, so what's my career? Am I supposed to be an accountant? Am I supposed to be a trash collector? Am I supposed to be a teacher? What's the will of God for my life? The will of God for your life is to become a person of love. Think of the fruit of the Spirit, love and joy and peace and patience and the rest. This is the will of God, that you become that kind of person. So you should become a joyful accountant and a peaceful trash collector or a patient teacher. You choose the career path, and remember, choose wisely, but you still choose. The will of God is determined not by which of these paths you take. The will of God is determined by what kind of person you are going to be in that career. So as these options are laid out before you, know you can find God behind anyone. And as you go through that door, you can be formed by God into the presence of his Son. This is the will of God. Now the question is, what about sin? What about that door? What about the door that I know is labeled sin? There's a big circle with an X. It says, do not enter. I know I shouldn't enter. But what about that road behind that door that leads to destruction? What about going there? Proverbs chapter 14, verse 12 says, "There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death." And it's true. There is no doubt. You can choose to go through a door, even if you know, or maybe you don't fully know the consequences, but particularly if you know this is the wrong way to go. You can go through that door, and it can feel right at the beginning, but you can go through that door, and the truth is it'll lead you to heartache and pain, hell, and ultimately death. But the good news is that God is still there. Because when we say that God is behind every door, God is even behind that door that's marked sin. Now again, certainly we will experience the consequences of our actions. So say you want a career that brings you lots of wealth. Say you want a career where you can make a lot of money and be rich, even though it may cost you your dignity and your family. And your very soul, you know that. That's the door you want to go through. You can go through that door and you will experience the pain and the heartache and the emptiness and the loneliness that comes from the pursuit of greed. But there's still good news. God can be found there. Because God is a God of love, and there is no place where God cannot be found. So if you sow towards greed, you will reap the destruction and heartache and loneliness. I mean, I can't say that if you go down the path of destruction, that God will completely save you from that. All I'm saying that is even if you go that way, God can be found. Jonathan Martin says later in chapter 6 that God is not the cosmic enforcer of karma, making sure we get what we deserve. God is the one who interrupts the cycle with grace. In other words, while we do reap what we sow, and if you go a way of destruction, you're going to reap destruction if you choose to go that way. That while we do reap what we sow, this is not the end of the story. The Choose Your Own Adventure has 28 different endings. And some of them, because I kind of flipped through, because we... And taking my six-year-old through it, he did end up in one place where he couldn't find his friend Carlos, and he didn't find any Yeti, and it was really sad. But I was kind of flipping through some of the other endings, and some of it you get chased by the Yetis. They're like busting up your trekking poles, and it's frightening. And there's some discouraging endings in here. And so it's very true, just to be honest, that that's the way of life. You go the way of destruction, it may not end well for you, but here is the good news. It's not the end of the story. That if you go the way of destruction, you meet death. But the God we worship is not the God of karma. He's the God of resurrection. So you can go that way of sin and destruction and death, and there may be a real death on the inside of you, but the good news is that God can raise you to life again. So even if you choose to go that way, he's there. Jesus says, Matthew chapter 7, "Enter by the narrow gate. For the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction. And those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life. And those who find it are few." Very often we hear that and we say, well, there's this one narrow road. It's where Jesus is. And there's this way of destruction. That's where all the bad people go, totally away from Jesus. But I think it's not true. Jesus wants us to enter through the narrow way, but even if we go the way of destruction, God is there with his love to rescue us and to heal us and to restore us. So as we are on this adventure making choices, if you walk through one of those doors of destruction and you realize it, all you have to simply do is stop and acknowledge the presence of God and turn from the ways of destruction and turn to God, and he can heal and save and rescue you. And on this adventure of our own choosing, Jesus invites us to come to his table that we might have strength for the journey. when the people of God were led by Moses out of Egyptian slavery through the Red Sea, out into the wilderness, they were cared for by God. They were provided. Their needs were provided for. God provided food for them to eat while they were in the wilderness. It's called manna. Manna is a Hebrew word for, what the heck is this? That's what manna is. What the heck is this? Because they didn't know what it was. Because it's, you know, food falling from heaven. You know, they would, you know, be sleeping in their tents and they would go out in the morning and there was, what the heck is this? And that's what they ate, three meals a day. In the morning, they would have their scrambled, what the heck is this? For lunch, it was always, what the heck is this sandwiches. At night, there's a variety, man. You can have barbecued, what the heck is this? Or broiled, what the heck is this? But I didn't know what it was. It's provided by God. And God provided for his people while they were wandering and in this adventure through the wilderness to the promised land. And Jesus comes saying, I am the bread from heaven. You know that, what the heck is this that was given to you from heaven? Jesus said, I am that bread of life given to sustain the people of God. And when we come to the communion table, we come to encounter the bread of life that we could be sustained as we are choosing our own adventure in this journey of following Jesus. So let's prepare.